Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's time for our dive into the news. And with me this week, snuggled up together if you're watching on the podcast on YouTube, because we've moved the chairs around a little bit, is our Head of Local Ministries, Graham Bynan. Good morning, Graham.
Hi, good morning, Phil.
And our National Director, John Stevens. Hello, John.
Hi, Phil.
Good to see you both. We'll get on to some news stories in a couple of minutes. Before we do that, just worth saying a couple of things. One, our local conferences are now ready for booking, aren't they, Graham? Just give us a quick potted guide of what's happening at the local conferences and how people can book for them.
Yeah, thank you. Our local conferences run from just the end of February through to June, 27 locations across the country. Great opportunity to get together with leaders. That's leaders of all sorts, pastors, elders, youth workers, other workers, and so on, in different areas to meet together, encourage each other. And the theme we are thinking about is proving yourself.
Go on. That sounds very intriguing. What do we mean by that?
It's how, well, you have to read the subtitle, How Justification Changes Ministry.
Which is linked to what we did at our Leaders Conference in November.
So flowing out of the Leaders Conference, the idea that because we're justified through Christ, justified by grace and by faith, we don't have to prove ourselves. And that's true in life in general, but it's also true in ministry. And I think probably most of us would know that instinctively, but we're going to try and kind of dig into that more deeply and think how that really shapes how we do ministry and who we are in ministry. I think it's a really rich topic. I hope it'll be really encouraging to people. 27 locations around the country. Go to the website, local conferences, find the one nearest you or one that you can make the date of not too far away.
Fantastic. You can book on there and free of charge, I think, as well, aren't they? Which is excellent. So we look forward to that. And just sticking with you for a moment, Graham, you're also in the process of setting up a ministry team to think specifically about church planting, which is really exciting. Just tell us a bit about what you're hoping that will help our churches with.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth saying the FIEC is, you know, FIEC has seen many, many churches planted, initiated by our churches and with some guidance from kind of the central people occasionally. We want to just lean into that more and be helpful to churches. So we're setting up a team of people with experience in planting. It seems to me that churches will vary. Some will have it on their radar and be able to get on with it pretty well. Others need to be kind of prompted to think about it. When might it be good? Why would it be good? And then what are the first steps? You know, where do we start even? And then what are the next steps and so on? So coaching churches through where they are less familiar with what has going to have to happen. Providing coaching for planters themselves. That can often be a really helpful thing. And then providing ongoing support for planters. Some will be part of great networks, be in good support systems already. Some planters, in my experience, are very isolated. So gathering a team to think through how can we best help FIEC churches plant and reach into areas, whether it's locally or further afield in our country, where they desperately need a gospel preaching church.
Sounds fantastic. And we look forward to seeing how that will operate and work, Graham. And John, your role with FIEC is to make those national connections. And you've been doing that this week with Terry Virgo from New Frontiers.
Yeah, it's great. I've got, for about 10 years, I've been invited to a gathering of leaders that meets for 24 hours once a year that Terry Virgo convenes. It's a wide range of people there. There are sort of 20, 25 leaders or so. I think quite a lot, obviously, coming out of a New Frontiers background, a number of others from a kind of a charismatic independent church kind of world. But also myself, I was there, the kind of the Baptist Union guys. There were people in the Church of England. It was great hearing from them about how they're contending for the gospel in those very kind of difficult circumstances there. Living Leadership was represented, kind of Union School of Theology. So it's a kind of a broad spectrum of kind of evangelicalism. And yeah, it's just been a great fellowship over that time. We don't really do very much other than just sit around a circle and share what the Lord is doing in our particular kind of area, ministry, church, and things that we're seeing, things that we're learning, things that are on our heart. So it's a great opportunity to hear about how the Lord is at work in multiple kind of places. So I'm always blessed by that. They've become good friendships kind of over the years. And I think every time I am just sort of humbled to realize that the church, the kingdom of God, is way bigger than the little corner in which we're working. I think one of our sort of real challenges is we can become so focused just on our own particular place. I'm actually an independency on your own local church and not having much of a vision beyond that. And actually, we need to remember that in the big scheme of things, we're all tiny. We're all just doing a little bit of work in the kingdom of God. And we need to kind of, I think, actually rejoice in, support, encourage the work of the gospel. So it was fascinating. I think big themes that were coming out from our time together, just multiple stories of growing churches. I think that was really encouraging, sort of hearing of church growth and indeed people coming to church, remarkable conversions. So actually across a whole raft of networks, people basically reporting surprising growth. Well, I would say that that reflects some of what we've been saying, that actually the Lord seems to be at work at the moment in a remarkable way. We've even seen that in our own local church of drawing people. And I think that awareness that we're against a cultural background in which the nation is moving further and further away from God. But as we said, at one level, the darker the culture, the brighter the gospel sort of shines, and the more important the hope of the church is. And there just seems to be something really going on there. I think another big issue was leadership, the whole question of raising up kind of leaders for the church, the kind of changing culture of a younger generation, actually people's fear of leading at the moment in a culture which is suspicious of any kind of authority. Every network is struggling with that, as well as recognizing there have been some bad leadership examples that have needed to be addressed, which have been deeply painful, and that's universal. And I think, again, at one level, it's helpful to know that that is not a problem of one particular little corner of evangelicalism. That's actually generic in a fallen world where kind of people will misuse power and misuse kind of authority. And then finally, I was just reminded, comment one leader made, just the real importance of recognizing the way that our congregation members are out there in the world, on the front line, exercising influence for Jesus, able to speak for him. We can so easily make ourselves and church ministry the center of the story. But very often the place where the gospel is brought to bear on people's lives is the doctors, the teachers, the person in the factory, the guy working in the civil service. Just that is where kind of mission takes place. And it's so important that we as church leaders recognize that it's our people who are in the end on the front line doing that work of witnessing for Christ and supporting and encouraging them in that. So I was really helped by that.
So it's a week of meeting with leaders. Let's talk about leadership as we look at our first news story. There was a letter written earlier in the week by Simon Clark, an MP, to the chair of the 1922 committee of the Conservative Party, nonetheless, basically saying it's time for Rishi Sunak to step back as leader. The Conservatives will be annihilated at the next election. Not sure that was the word he used. If they don't replace Rishi Sunak, and the only way that there's any chance of the Conservatives winning the next election is by replacing the leader. Is he right?
Who knows? I mean, this was supposedly based on some survey done, but as I mean, I've not dug into it completely, but as far as I can tell, it's unclear quite what that involved. But that means they're kind of waving some form of evidence around, going, I've got a basis for this, but that's not very transparent.
What's interesting is I heard a data expert talking about this, and basically the survey was asking people, if we replaced the leader with somebody who did all the things that you wanted them to do, would you vote for them? Yeah. To which the answer, unsurprisingly, was yes. Yeah. So So yeah, it doesn't seem overly transparent. But is changing a leader always the answer to success?
Well, not necessarily. And I think actually one has to recognize there's a massive challenge within the Conservative Party at the moment, in that it's a very divided party with people with a very different vision of kind of what the party ought to be doing and what it ought to be standing for. So really, since Brexit, since 2019, there's been this kind of coalition between the red wall and the blue wall, constituencies that were Labour constituencies that were more working class, Brexit supporting. Heartlands of conservatism in the southeast would be more middle class, more educated, probably more Remain leading. And actually holding those two groups together when actually they have fundamentally different visions as to the kind of country we should be and the policies that we should have is extraordinarily difficult. I think it's worth recognizing the massive victory of 2019 was a consequence of wider circumstances. Namely, the kind of the need to get Brexit done and a total frustration with the gridlock that had been caused in British politics. Plus also at the same time, I think actually amongst traditional Labour voters, an unwillingness to support Corbyn and his kind of apparently unpatriotic extreme socialist kind of view. So the reason why they won in 2019 is a result of those other factors, not because they were necessarily the party that people would naturally election after election choose. It's always hardest to lead after you've had a major victory, which has been driven by other circumstances that are no longer there. So I think that's an extremely difficult situation, and you can see how that's played out in kind of the leadership. So there are people who don't want the leader, whoever that is. It was true of Liz Truss. It's now true of kind of Sunak, because they don't agree with his policies. And then for others, they don't like his personality. They think he's too managerial. He's not visionary enough. He doesn't sort of speak to the public in quite the way that they want. So there's always going to be groups who want to get rid of a leader who they think doesn't represent their position and who doesn't reflect their kind of personality. And I think that's true in church life. That's true in organizational leadership. There will be people who don't like the leadership because of the policies that it has, and because the personality doesn't lead in the way that they want and they can most identify with. Having said that, it looks like the vast majority of the party does support sort of Sunak and the direction he's going. And the Rwanda vote, you know, there was all the talk of the massive rebellion against it. And
didn't really materialize.
In the end, yeah. 11 people voted against the government. Kind of the deputy chairman who resigned, who made a load of fuss about it, has now come out and said he wished he'd voted for the government, and can he have his job back? Yeah. I mean, it's a classic case of a guy who kind of postured in rebellion, and then when it doesn't work out, ends up actually almost in a sense desperate to be sort of re-welcomed in. Simon Clark comes out with this big thing, you know, Sunak's got to go. Senior members of the party and people who would sympathise with his position basically said, don't be ridiculous. Mm. So I think that if you ask the question, is the leadership issue going to be what determines the next election? I suspect probably not. The reason why the publics get fed up with governments that have been in a long time and that don't necessarily have a positive record. Sunak has clearly got a plan of improve the economy, cut taxes, deal with inflation, show that you're a steady hand and that things will improve and it will be risky to vote for somebody. So he's following a strategy, which obviously some people think is not radical enough. And in the end, the vast majority are going to go with him because they actually think that changing the leader is just going to make things worse. Mm. And I think again, in church life, that's the case. You often have discontents in church life. In church, you want to get rid of the leader, get rid of the pastor. They have very loud voices. When it comes to the crunch, they often are a small minority who make a lot of noise and get a lot of attention. But actually, the vast majority of people are supportive of the leadership.
Graham, how do you deal in church life with the kind of the howler letter that arrives from a church member, perhaps furious about something that's happened in the church? They don't like the way you've led something. We've all had those kind of negative pieces of correspondence. What do you do with that? How do you react to that as a church leader?
Yeah, I think you obviously try and listen carefully. I mean, there are very obvious steps, aren't there? Is there truth in it, even if it's overstated? Even if it's said badly, is what it's saying still contains something to hear? Leaders will make all kinds of mistakes. We mustn't get into the "I must just defend everything I do" mentality. It may be I defend what I did, but I apologize for the way I did it, and so on. It depends on the specifics of the issue. I think here the broader issue is recognizing how widespread things can be within church life. Is this an individual? Is it a small minority? The great phrase, lots of people think, you know. Well, is that you and your friends? Is it an echo chamber? This is where leaders need to know their people well. As John says, many of those sorts of strong voices are very much minority voices. And ultimately, it means that church life and leadership is both around a united vision where even if we might disagree over some areas, there's enough togetherness about what we're about as a church. And leadership is all about relationships and trust. Mm. So even that person who writes the letter and doesn't like what you've done, that you are kind to them, that you listen to them, that will stand you in good stead.
Yeah, that's good advice.
A couple of, I mean, just in terms of leadership and church leadership, obviously the gospel is unchanging. the context of the moment that we're in is constantly changing. One of the challenges of leadership is how to bring the gospel to bear into a particular moment. And that depends on what the circumstances are, what the challenges are, what the best way of responding to them is. That requires a massive amount of wisdom and spiritual discernment. It's worth recognizing that Christians won't always agree on that. Mm. You know, actually, as politicians are trying to work out how do they bring their core principles to bear at a particular moment in history, wanting all of them, presumably, to try to bring about what they see as a better society. At one level, churches, we have to recognize there isn't going to be a unanimity on that, and we do have to work through that. I think it's therefore hugely important to listen to others, that inevitably every church is a sort of coalition. Mm. And you do need to listen to all of the voices in order to help kind of shape and develop what the right way is to respond. You need all of those insights to be able to see how to be able to lead kind of as a whole, and that requires wisdom. If you just become sort of deaf to what everybody's saying, that will build up the rebellion. Mm. Rightly so, because you're no longer sensitive and listening. There's also a point at which actually for some people, actually the right thing is for them to go elsewhere. If they don't want to support a particular church, a church's leaders and its direction, but that's the view of the church as a whole, at one level you recognize that that is not then the right place for you. I mean, it's like politicians ultimately deciding to cross the floor and join another party because they realize that that better represents what they believe in, what they want to do in. And I think sometimes there is an appropriate place for people to say, okay, the leadership has decided this. They believe in good conscience. This is the right thing to be doing. It's not what we agree with. And if we want to pursue something else, actually, it's right to go and find people with whom you can pursue that. And there's that balance between people making that choice because it's the right thing for them to do, and the kind of the Mark Driscoll leadership of throwing people under the bus because mm. they're not with you. That's absolutely not what we should be doing. But there is also a right and proper place for people sometimes to say, given what I believe in, given what I want to see happen, actually, I need to kind of identify myself with a different church, a different leader, because that will be mutually beneficial to everyone.
And leaders need to help people leave well in those circumstances, mm. don't they, Graham?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've seen this from both sides, but take the side where someone turns up at my church saying, I'm wondering about coming here. One of my first questions is, have you spoken to your leaders? So there's a responsibility of the people to go to their leaders and say, I'm wrestling with this, you know I struggle with this, or whatever the issue is, help me think this through. Hmm. And that's actually a very humble thing to do, a very hard thing to do, but exactly the right thing to do. And then leaders have a responsibility when they know people are discontent to not to, you know, keep on prying and try and force them to stay or whatever, or force them to leave, but just to try and be proactive in saying, let me help you make the most honoring and wise decision in this situation.
Kind of Terry Virgo gathering, it's just worth recognizing that the church is way bigger than just my individual local church, with a spectrum of different sort of theological views on secondary issues, different ministry philosophies, different focuses on what they're going to do. We can all serve in different places. And at one level, you have to find where are you going to most flourish, given your heart calling and beliefs within the kind of the Church of Jesus Christ.
Let's move on. Let's talk about something that's happened over in the United States in this past 24 hours. So this is an execution, of course, in the US. Some states over there still exercise capital punishment. It's a chap called Kenneth Smith, who was found guilty of a homicide dating back to the late 1980s, was executed in the US in this last 24 hours using nitrogen gas. This is a thing that had never been done before. There was all sorts of concerns about how it would be done. It's been labeled in some quarters completely barbaric. The Attorney General in the States has said justice has been served, and this went as they thought that it would. Where do we stand on this? The issue of capital punishment under the new covenant. What? How do we respond? Who wants to take that one?
Well, I'll set it up, and then John can answer it.
Yeah, good.
So, I mean, obviously, we distinguish between two issues. One is whether you kill people for crimes, capital punishment, and then how you do. Here, the main issue is on the how. Mm. A new technique. They actually tried to put him to death a couple of years ago by lethal injection, but couldn't do it because they couldn't get, couldn't find veins and so on. And there's basically now a dispute between the different experts on was this, it was supposedly quick and painless. And then others who actually watched the execution in the early hours of our morning said it certainly didn't look like that. And I imagine that, so that's going to be the debate. What actually was that experience like? Because even if you do believe in capital punishment, I take it we'd all agree that you kill people as painlessly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you do, John will tell us.
Yeah. Landed on me. Theologically, I in a sense support the death penalty for murder. It seems to me that that's established by God in the covenant with Noah. It's not actually an old covenant, new covenant issue. It seems to be fundamental to the justice that God establishes in the world. There he commands that if somebody spills life, their life should be spilled. There's a justice and appropriate principle of retributive punishment that matches the crime. It's in a sense an extension of that principle, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, which is not about kind of revenge. It's actually about proportionality.
Mm.
And where a person has kind of taken the life of another deliberately, I think the Bible teaches that actually the sort of government does have the right to take the life of that person. That's in a sense what it means, that the state bears the sword. So at a theological level, I kind of think it's right and appropriate that the death penalty can be applied to those who have committed kind of murder. Then you've got to caveat that in a whole variety of ways, because I think that there's a whole question of the process of how that happens. So that the Bible, the Old Testament, makes very clear that there are high evidential requirements for determining whether a person was sort of guilty. So the necessity for evidence that proves that that is the case. The Old Testament teases out very much the difference between deliberate, intentional, premeditated murder and when somebody is killed kind of accidentally or without that. So there's this case in Nottingham at the moment of the guy who has been found guilty of manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility because he has a mental illness. And there's been some outrage about the sentence that's been received, but that's really all about culpability. So harm-wise, he has killed three people and that's kind of really wicked.
And that's not in doubt.
That's not in doubt. The question is, would he be culpable given his mental state for what he's done? Is that a premeditated intentional murder, or does it fall into those other categories? I think in the States, there are all sorts of issues with the death penalty over the way that that is applied and whether that is applied fairly to different racial groups, which is bound up with prejudice. It's bound up with the provision of lawyers. It's bound up with the provision of kind of defense. Irrespective of the method of execution, I think you have to say that here is somebody who's being executed something like 35 years after they've committed a crime. Mm. And actually, the crime was awful. Here is a man who was paid to kill a pastor's wife.
Yeah, he's a contract killer.
A paid assassin. Yeah. This is kind of, you know, almost the worst kind of calculated murder that there could be. But 35 years is an extraordinary period of time. And I think it's an utter failure of a judicial system that if it does believe in the kind of the death penalty, it takes that long for it to resolve. Ironically, if you go back to the English death penalty cases, death penalty was abolished in 1965. People were usually executed within 2 weeks of being convicted. That was normal. That was how the process was done, including all appeals. So there's an injustice and an inhumanity in the whole extended period, kind of anyway. I think then, Graham, the issue of how you kill someone and... At one level, there is no easy way to kill people. You know, actually, we all fight death. Mm. And I think Americans in particular want the death penalty, and then they kind of want to argue for kind of humane methods of execution. And it's a peculiar aspect of the American culture that it kind of thinks technology is the answer to that. And actually, the 20th century, America has advocated the kind of electric chair, the kind of the gas chamber, then lethal injection, then kind of nitrogen gas, all as being more humane than other ways of execution. When actually, most of them take significantly longer than the ways that people were being killed beforehand, but those other ways tended to disfigure the body. There's all sorts of questions. Is this a legitimate way to kill someone? Well, there's no kind of, in a sense, easy way to kill someone. I don't think we should deceive ourselves that technology leads to humanity there, but... Still, the biblical principle is that kind of a death penalty for murder is established by God. And we shouldn't forget that biblically that was by stoning. So that is what God ordained as the community punishment in many of those cases.
Let's come back closer to home. I want to talk for a few minutes about the Michaela School in London. So this is the school dubbed the strictest school in Britain. Head teacher Catherine Birbal Singh has become quite well known in education circles for her kind of no-nonsense attitude to secondary school education. She can point quite rightly to excellent exam results, well-behaved children, and all that goes with that. But it's hit the headlines this week, essentially because the headlines say she has banned prayer. And I think what this means is that there have been a number of Muslim pupils in the school who have wanted to pray as per the Islamic religion. They've been doing that in playgrounds. Catherine Birbal Singh says there isn't room in the school for a prayer room for the Muslim students. She says we're a secular school, so she has banned the pupils from praying. And that has led to a Muslim pupil or Muslim pupil's parents taking legal action against the school to say my child should be allowed to pray as per their religion. What do we make of this? Is this says it's a secular school? Does that mean she's got every right to say the Muslim students cannot pray and we should commend and support that as Christians, John?
Well, I mean, I think this is a big challenge at the moment, and it's all the question of how do we manage to navigate being a multicultural, multi-faith, multi-ethnic society.
And that's what's going on in this school,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, because, what does secularism mean? Now, we've got to be careful because there are particular circumstances here. I don't know the full details of kind of starting praying. Then there was some hostility towards teachers. There was some abuse, some racist abuse that was bound up with that. So it obviously became a very emotive issue there within this sort of school. It seems to me that it boils down to the question of what do we mean by secularism and how do we respect people's faith convictions? So essentially, there's an assumption here that secularism means the exclusion of religion altogether. So, and actually others would advocate that. Polly Toynbee, writing in The Guardian this week, said basically ban all prayer and religion in schools. Actually, the British Humanist Society has leapt on this as, you know, get rid of religion kind of in schools. Now, of course, we do have some religious schools. And actually, it's clear in those that they're going to follow the practice of a particular religion, church schools, Muslim schools, Jewish schools. And many parents choose those because that is what they want. I personally think that it seems to me to be a kind of unwise to think that secularism basically means the elimination of religion from the public square, which is what is being said here. And I think people who take that view generally tend to be secularists who have no understanding of religion and its importance in people's lives. It's effectively the same as saying a key aspect of your identity should be kind of eliminated. So it's ironic that the very kind of people who would be opposed most to, say, for example, conversion therapy, because they see sort of homosexuality as being a core identity that should not be suppressed, are actually arguing that religion should be suppressed, as if it's just a kind of a chosen behavior that occasionally you engage in, rather than core to your very identity and sense of self. So if you're a committed Muslim, praying five times a day, it is actually what you believe is core to your very identity. So it seems to me that it's much more appropriate that you try to facilitate people's ability to be able to reflect their different religious beliefs and then live together in harmony with each other.
It's just worth saying on that point, I read a Muslim journalist this morning who said when Muslim children get to a certain age, it is expected that they pray five times a day. So the point is they will have reached that age within the school and then wanted to start praying. So that's why it will have happened in the way that it's happened, was the argument. Sorry, I interrupted you.
It's important to say. A whole load of things, isn't it? Actually, sort of the law does make exceptions. Sikhs don't have to wear kind of motorcycle helmets when they're driving, when everybody else does, because it's recognized that wearing a turban is intrinsic to their religion. You know, can you imagine a school banning Jewish children from wearing a skull cap because they saw that as part of their religion? So I think that's, it seems to me a dangerous desire to want to eliminate religion as if that's the way you create a harmonious society. And the bit of it that I think I find really difficult is that the lady, the headmistress, spoke about how they stood by British values and therefore kind of there are three songs they sing regularly in their corporate gatherings. They sing God Save the King, they sing I Vow to You My Country, and they sing Jerusalem. Now, the idea that that is neutrality is utter nonsense. So kind of this idea that that is what British values are, that's exactly the problem. And I think this touches on some key issues of, in our society, what does it mean to be British? And the assumption behind that is British is a sort of kind of Christianish kind of outlook. The reality is that's not contemporary Britain. And we have to work out how do we construct a society in which you have these different religious groups for whom that is deeply part of their personal identity and life, but yet actually they are also part of a civic community. So, yeah.
Graham, what do you want to add to that? Because that was quite a very full answer.
Yeah, no, very good.
Wait, shall I ask you, did those feet in ancient times walk upon England's mountain green?
I think I'd just echo a couple of things. First, the complexity that there was intimidation, children being pressured into praying who weren't praying previously, these sorts of things.
So that's the allegations that have been made.
So just to say, there are those complexities, which some of which may make what the school has done more understandable. We should be aware of that. Secondly, of course, it's all to do with outward manifestation. It's because Muslim prayer is so ritualized. Certain times of day, certain positions, you can see if someone's praying or isn't. You can't tell if a Christian people is praying in the playground or not. And so it's a kind of elimination of anything that smacks of religious behavior or practice, hence things like a skullcap and so on. And so there's an interesting external internal issue going on. But lastly is what it's all rallying around, along with the songs. I've heard the headmistress say that they're asking pupils to buy into something bigger than themselves, that is our country. So it's a kind of nationalism trumps religion kind of idea. And frankly, as John said, that's just not where we live. You can't ask people to deny something about themselves for the sake of some idea of being British or living in Britain today.
And I think we, from a Christian perspective, again, it just reminds us that religious freedom goes all ways. You know, we might object if sort of prayers were being eliminated from kind of Christian schools in the name of secularism or Christianity were being kind of removed from the public sphere. And some Christians kind of have a great fear of Islam, and actually they're sort of in a sense saying, oh, great, this is being kind of restricted. And I think that's not the right way at all. Actually, if you want religious freedom for yourself, you have to be willing to extend that religious freedom to kind of others and defend the rights of others to be able to practice their faith in an appropriate way.
Great stuff. Yeah, my daughter in her Christmas Nativity, the first song they sang at Church of England school was Jesus, Saviour of the World. And I thought, praise God for that. That's good that she's allowed to do that, even in a school setting. And we should give thanks for that. Brothers, it's been great to talk about what's been going on in the news. I hope you have a really good weekend. Thank you so much for listening. If you've enjoyed it, do rate or leave a review so others can find it. And we'll look forward to speaking to you again very soon. Thank you.